History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Eugene Boulard lived one of the most interesting lives in the 20th century. He was the first American-born black fighter pilot, and he flew for France in the Foreign Legion. He grew up in the South, and his father left home when he was only 12 years old, so he ran away from his home in Georgia and lived with gypsies, then hopped a German freighter to Scotland, washed up in Europe with almost no money, but managed to rebuild his life, first becoming a professional boxer, then becoming a drummer in jazz clubs, and then becoming an assistant nightclub manager in Paris during the Jazz Age. He joined the French Foreign Legion, and after becoming wounded, became a fire pilot in the French Air Corps during World War I. He married a white socialite, he owned nightclubs, and then became a spy for French intelligence during World War II. He wanted to fight again, so he rejoined the French Foreign Legion, but was wounded in battle. He was then transported on a hospital ship back to New York City. He lived in America for several decades, but was finally recognized for his heroism by French President Charles de Gaulle, and was awarded the Croix de Guerre, the highest military honor in France. After his death, his biographer said that Boulard died just as he lived, game as hell. Well, Boulard has an amazing life, and it takes a lot to unpack it. To do so, we're joined with guest John Hagedorn, host of the podcast 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. I really enjoyed looking into Boulard's life, and I hope you enjoy this discussion with John Hagedorn. John, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Scott. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, so we've talked about a lot of interesting things on each other's respective podcasts, and you look at stories and heroes in history. And a discussion we had last year was on the topic of people who deserve their own movie. And if there's anyone who does deserve their own movie, I think it's today's guest. He's got a really interesting story.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more. This was one of those finds. And you know, as a podcaster, when you come upon a gem, it's just something that stays with you forever. And this story I had never heard of before. It's the story of Eugene Boulard. And we might have some language experts out there who say, well, it should be Bullard because he was, as we're going to find out, he was born in Georgia. But because he spent most of his lifetime in France and because his father came from Martinique as a slave, it's likely pronounced Boulard. Hmm. So that's what you'll be hearing throughout this interview. And I'll bet most of your listeners have never heard of Eugene Boulard.
Right. I mean, he's someone that I haven't. I'm doing a series now on World War I, so I'll think about how to put him into the mix. But a good starting point with his story is a 1959 episode of The Today Show. He's a guest on the show. He's African-American, but in addition to having a last name that has a French twist, Boulard, he also has the nickname Jacques. So, well, let's begin with that show appearance. Why was he a guest on The Today Show?
Perfect place to begin. And that's where we began with the first of three podcasts that we did on him on 1001 Heroes podcast. It's 1959. You've got basically three television stations, NBC, CBS, and ABC. There really wasn't anything else. So that consumed most of the television viewing audience. And NBC's Today Show, which is still running today, was a big, big morning show. And the announcer back at that time was a guy named Dave Garraway. And Dave would come into the Rockefeller Square Plaza, into the NBC building every morning to tape his show. And on the way in, he would always head up the elevator up to the seventh floor. And the elevator operator, he was a black guy, bespectacled man in his mid-50s, always with a smile, always very gracious. And Garraway would say good morning to him, and he'd say good morning to Garraway. And he wore an elevator operator uniform, and often he would have medals showing on his uniform. And Garraway had never asked him about it. He knew his name was Gene, and that was about it. And one day, Dave Garraway's boss at NBC said, did you ever talk to the elevator operator? And Garraway said, no. He said, do you know anything about his background? Garraway responded, no, I don't. He said, well, ask him. So the next day, the next morning he came in, he asked Gene what his background was. He said, well, and he said, he asked him what the medals were. And he said, well, he says, I fought in two world wars for France. I was the first American-born black fighter pilot in history, as far as I know. And these two medals are the Croix de Guerre, which is the highest military medal that France offers, and he was wearing two of them. And he had other medals as well. And Dave said, would you like to be a guest on my show? So here it was in 1959. He brought him on for a 10-minute piece, during which time Boulard gave him just a thumbnail history of what he had done, just in those 10 minutes, a history that would fill 1,000 pages in a book. Just incredible. He had served in World War I with the French Foreign Legion. He had been severely wounded, and then, because he still wanted to fight for what his home country was, France, he asked him if he could join the French Air Corps, and he joined the French Air Corps, and he shot down 2 German Fokkers in the process. Later on, he joined in World War II, again with the French Foreign Legion, fought in World War II, again heavily decorated. After that, returned to the States. But during that time in Paris, France, as we're going to find out today, he owned his own nightclub. He owned his own boxing and health club. He married a white French socialite. He knew all the jazz greats because he was a jazz musician, and he also ended up as a part owner of the biggest nightclub in Paris, at which time he was responsible for booking the talent. So he met all the great talent that had gathered during the jazz age there in Paris, and his life literally reads like a book. Just incredible. Hardly known at all in the United States. Hmm. And we'll find out why as we go forward. But that's what he told Garraway. And Garraway, during the course of the interview, had a little piece of plywood with all 43 medals that Boulard had earned tacked to this plywood. And after the interview, he basically disappeared again as really an unknown.
Well, let's look at his childhood, because it's very interesting. He eventually ends up in Europe. Amongst other Americans, the fought in the French Foreign Legion in World War I before America entered the war. Usually you see Ivy League graduates who have dreams of greatness. Other times you see bohemians who are living in Paris in the artistic scene. They're poets, they're painters, and they have also dreams of fighting for their adopted motherland, France. But for Jean Boulard, his story must be very different. So what was his child like that caused him to want to go overseas?
He was born to a very poor family in Columbus, Georgia. His mother was a Creek Indian. His father had come from Martinique as a slave, and a lot of them came over to the state of Georgia and joined the Creek Indian tribe because that was a welcome place for blacks to come. And his father was an educated man to the point where he had gone through schooling, and he had always told his kids, they had seven children together, he always told them to study as hard as you can, read as much as you can, and learn as much as you can, because it's not going to be easy for you being black in this world. And his father worked down on the docks as a longshoreman. He was a 6'4" tall guy, and he was a big man. And his nickname was Chief Big Ox. He was well-respected. He was well-liked. But he had a job foreman who was a white guy, and he was constantly on his back. And when this white guy was known for hitting guys with a stick from behind, and there wasn't much they could do about it, otherwise they'd lose their job and their only way of providing for their families. And one day he got a little carried away, and he hit Boulard too many times, too hard. Boulard picked him up and threw him down 15 feet into a loading bin and broke this guy up pretty bad. He didn't kill him, but he broke him up, and he knew what kind of trouble he was in. And it turns out, yes, there was a lynch mob after him. Their mom had died. He was their sole support to the family. He went back to the kids, and he said, listen, I'm going to have to leave you for a little while. You're going to be on your own. And they were on their own. He made it back after a few months, and he said, I'm going to have to go. You're going to have to take care of yourselves. At age 12, Gene ran away from home, figuring his life on the road would be much better. His dad had always told him one thing. He said, if you're ever able, set your sights and your dreams on trying to make it to Europe, to France. Because there, in Europe and in France, black people are treated pretty much regular, not like they are here in this country. So Gene always had that dream to do that. He ran away from home and went up to outside of Atlanta, where a gypsy family finally kind of found him, and he found them. And they trained him horse knowledge in horses, how to raise them, how to breed them, and how to ride them. And he became a pretty good horse rider. After spending a couple years with a gypsy family, he moved on to another family, stayed with them for a year, and they taught him more about horses, and they taught him a little bit about fighting. But his dream was still set on making it to Europe. So when he reached age 18, he left. He headed south to Norfolk, Virginia, and tried to get on a few ships out, but none would take him. And he was able to stow away on a German freighter. He got on this German freighter and was a stowaway, and when they found him, they threatened to throw him overboard, but the captain took a liking to him. The kid had a smile, would just warm your heart, and he was smart, and he was willing to work. And the captain put him to work at every crummy odd job you could think of having. And Boulard took to it very, very well. He started to ask guys how to speak German and started to learn the language while he was on this ship and while he was working hard. And when they finally made it, the ship made it to Aberdeen, Scotland. And he got up. Instead of them letting him off the ship where customs would have picked him up, they took the special time. They developed a liking for this kid. So they rowed him at night into shore and let him go and said goodbye and good luck. And he was on his own, all alone, 18 years old in Aberdeen, Scotland.
So what do you do from there? I know the next step is he becomes a boxer, but how does he go from landing on the shores of Europe with presumably little or no money, no connections? How does he take the next step?
He started working odd jobs, and one odd job he took was for kind of gangs. He would be a lookout for gangs who were doing just black market sales in Aberdeen. And then he got away from that and started taking honest jobs. He finally started working as a longshoreman, but to work as a longshoreman, he had to start working out. So he went to a health club using the money he had to try and build up his body. He was only 140, 145 pounds. And when he went to the health club, they realized this guy's an athlete, and they started to train him how to box. An American boxer called Kid Dixie kind of put his wings around him and taught him more about boxing, and he became a pro boxer. So he was actually on the pro boxing circuit for about 6 months, and at that time moved up to Glasgow. And while he was in Glasgow, he's making money there boxing. He was encouraged by one of the guys to join a traveling minstrel show. And back then, this was a black traveling minstrel show, and they had what they called pickaninnies, which were basically younger kids who would entertain the audience between acts or between scenes. And he worked as a pickaninny during that time and traveled with this show to Europe. And they hit all the major cities in Europe. And when he hit Paris, he said, "That's it, guys. I'm staying here in Paris." So he's on his own. He's now just a little over 18 years old. And he's in Paris. He's associated with a health club. And then he starts working as a jazz drummer for some nightclubs because he also had a lot of musical ability. So he's learning French rapidly in Paris because he wants to learn it. The people, and in his diary that he wrote just before he died, he said, "From the time I reached Scotland and then traveled Europe and then went to Paris, I realized that although being black, you certainly still would get catcalls and you'd get some comments, but it was nothing like the hatred that he had experienced back in the States." And he wanted to make that clear. He said, "They don't have that mindset of we own you in Europe. You were pretty much going to be judged for what you did and how quick you learned and how honest you were and what kind of person you were in Europe, whereas you didn't get that kind of judgment in the U.S. And he realized his father was right. And that was a big realization for him. And he fell in love with Paris. He fell in love with France. So then war broke out.
And when he married a white socialite in Paris, was that before World War I or during or after?
That was after World War I.
Oh, okay. So we won't get ahead of ourselves then.
Yeah.
From this point, when World War I breaks out, the French Foreign Legion issues a call for people to join. How does he get involved? Does he know other Americans in Paris? Does he see that if I'm going to join the war effort, I can't be a regular enlisted soldier because I'm not a citizen? How does he find himself involved with the Foreign Legion?
He tried to enlist, but because he was born in America, the only place that he could join and fight for France was in the Foreign Legion. And they had a special division called the Moroccan Division. And that Moroccan Division had people from 52 different countries fighting in it. And he was very welcome to join the Moroccan Division. World War I had broken out, and it was raging. And as you know, based on the series that you're doing now, World War I, just a killing bath. And they were going through as many recruits as they could send over there. And he was a machine gunner. He was a lightweight, but he was a machine gunner. First, he started delivering messages as an envoy, and then they put him on machine guns. And he was an excellent fighter. He was earning medals early on in that campaign. He was 18 when he joined. He was sent to the front in Somme. He was sent to the Somme front in the Moroccan division. He fought in the Battle of Artois in May of 1915. And in that one battle, there were 300,000 French killed. And a lot of the fighting was bayonet fighting up close. And he was very good. He was quick. He was light and he was quick.
And then when he becomes a pilot, this is interesting because I know there's different ways that Americans were fighter pilots. Sometimes it was with the Foreign Legion. And then I think that was rolled up into the French Air Corps. There was a special unit, I think, of Americans before America formally entered the war. They called themselves the Lafayette Corps, something like that, named after the
Lafayette Escadrille.
Yeah, Lafayette Escadrille, named after the Marquis de Lafayette in the Revolutionary War.
Yep.
To make it very clear that even though America is, we couldn't officially call ourselves Americans because the American government didn't want to signal they were leaning toward the Central or the Allied powers, but the Americans themselves made it very clear who we were. So how was Boulard involved as a fighter pilot?
He went to the French Aeronautical Club. Because he had been badly wounded, I should mention. So he could not, he was out of the infantry, he was too badly wounded, but he could still fly a plane, and he still wanted to fight for his home country. So he went to the French Aeronautics Club and joined them, had no problem joining them. He actually got his license. So he began to train, they gave him a SPAD, and he began to train with the SPAD, did extremely well, and he flew 23 missions, I believe it was, over France. And he was managed to shoot down two German planes. There was a point at which the Americans joined the war. And at that point, when the Americans joined the war, there was a guy already over there who was an American guy who was forming that American part of the Lafayette Escadrille. And Boulard, because he was American by birth, wanted to join that. But they refused him. This guy refused him because he was black.
When he wins the Croix de Guerre, being recognized by the French government, what particularly was he honored for?
You know what? That's a good question, but I don't have the answer on that one. I know he was wounded March 5th, 1916 in Verdun. Mm-hmm. The battle was one of the longest battles in history. And that battle lasted 303 days, 714,000 casualties. Mm-hmm. Just a huge bloodbath. He was cited for bravery and heroics during the Battle of Verdun. In 1917. He was cited in 1917 for what he had done in 1916.
Right.
And he had won that fighting for the Legionnaires.
Well, going to his life after the war, I'm sure he's feeling very conflicted about his homeland because on one hand, he's fighting on behalf of America for France before America formally enters the war with the Foreign Legion. On the other hand, he is snubbed by his homeland because they won't let him into the Lafayette Escadrille because he's black. So he stays in Paris after the war. Let's go through his life between the wars. What's his next step?
Yeah, when the war ended, he was 20 years old. And he started to pick up again with jazz drumming. And he connected with some very important people in Paris at that time. The United States was under prohibition. And all the U.S. servicemen who were still in France still hadn't come home yet. Were kind of staying in Paris and staying in France because they were enjoying the nightclubs. And jazz was really just starting to become extremely popular. And Boulard was right in the middle of all this. He became the assistant manager for a guy who owned a number of jazz clubs in the Montmartre district of Paris, which is where jazz was raging. You had all kinds of talent in there. People like you've heard of, like Louis Armstrong. Mm-hmm. There were a couple others. There was one called Bricktop mm-hmm. Smith. I forget her first name, though, but she was called Bricktop Smith. And there were a lot of other jazz people who became jazz greats during that time. And it all happened in the Montmartre district of Paris. You had guys like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Hemingway attending these bars. It was mostly entertainment for servicemen and mostly wealthy whites. Mm-hmm. Who all mixed into this jazz age time that they were having. And then the place was called Zelly's. There was a guy named Zelly who had owned nightclubs in New York and owned nightclubs in London, and now he was taking advantage of the jazz age in Paris. And he made Boulard assistant manager. And he also put Boulard in charge of recruiting new talent. So that was how he met a lot of these jazz greats. Later in his life, he would end up as the road guy for Louis Armstrong because of the friendships, because of the ties that they had made back then in the 20s in the jazz district. And that was when he met the daughter of a wealthy family in Paris. She was a white socialite, very, very wealthy family. And he married her, and they had two children in the process. And during this time, he had now worked his way from manager to co-owner, and from co-owner to owner of his own nightclub, which he called the Lafayette Escadrille. So he had a nightclub and he had a health club. Both were making very, very good money, but a lot of it was night work. And after a couple of years, his wife tired of the night work, and she said, "Listen, you know, I would like to have you home at night. Can you find a way to just let other people manage this?" But like many of us, he wanted to manage it and do it himself. He said, "I just can't stay home and be your gigolo," was what he said in his diary. He said, "I have to be myself, and I have to work it myself and do it my own way." And they parted company, and when they did, he got custody of their two daughters.
Hmm.
So now the two daughters were his responsibility. He's still in Paris, France. He is divorced, and the 20s moved into the 30s. By the late 1930s, the jazz clubs were no more. But he still had his health club. And in 1936, the French intelligence approached him and said, "Listen, we have troubles brewing with Germany again. And because you know three languages, because you're familiar in English, you're familiar in French, and you're very familiar in German, we need you to provide us with intelligence." So they assigned him a co-agent named Kitty. And this Kitty was pretty well connected. She was later able to take care of his daughters when he entered World War II, again with the French Foreign Legion. But he would tend tables, and he would mix with these German guys. There were 17,000 Germans living in Paris in 1937. And Paris intelligence knew that they needed to try and get their information and their people, their sources squared away. He was one of them. Josephine Baker, who was another great jazz singer, she was also a French intelligence agent. And they'd go by the tables, and the Germans never suspected. Mm. Here comes these black waiters. They didn't know it was owners. Here comes Boulard as a black waiter waiting on their table, and they're talking about strategies and what's going down and what Germany's going to do, never figuring he could understand German. But he passed a lot of that good information off to French intelligence during that time. And when war broke out in 1939, the French are fighting again. And he went back to the Legionnaires and joined again.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. I'm really fascinated about that part of spycraft, that it's not about the James Bond person you send in who's the most visible, flashy target. It's the person that everybody overlooks, the guy who checks in coats in the cloakroom, the waiter, the person that just seems part of the background so people speak freely. And they shouldn't speak freely, but they do. But he's right there to gather that intelligence. So that's really amazing that he managed to fit into there right at that time. So when he rejoins the war effort in World War II, is he fighting again for the Foreign Legion?
He is. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to take a sidebar, if you don't mind.
Yes.
On that intelligence. And about how it's the waiter, or it's the person you least mm-hmm. expect. And this little sidebar, because you mentioned Lafayette before, because we talked about the Lafayette Escadrille. Lafayette had a spy in Yorktown who was a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Washington.
Right.
And the British commander there at Yorktown, Cornwallis. And this guy was working in the staff for Cornwallis and delivering meals to the tables. He was just a lowly servant in Cornwallis's staff. He had reported back to Lafayette on a lot of the things that were going on, the British plans. When Lafayette made his victory tour in the United States, this was maybe 20 years or 30 years mm-hmm. after the American Revolution ended. Lafayette is making the trip a hero by carriage. Up from Yorktown, I think he went from Williamsburg to Yorktown. And the roads were lined, just solid lined with people who wanted to see Lafayette, who was treated as an American hero, even though he was a Frenchman. And Lafayette saw somebody in the crowd that he recognized. And he asked the driver to stop. And Lafayette jumped out of the carriage and went and hugged this black guy, just out of nowhere. And as the story goes, this guy was his spy at Yorktown. And they hugged, and there were just tears coming down their faces. And the guy said, "I have a paper here that confirms my identity and the fact that I was in your employ in the revolution. Would you mind signing it so I can legally buy property?" And Lafayette said, "Of course." And he signed that paper, Lafayette. And that guy did raise a family on a nice farm that he was able to buy. And just a little side story. Didn't mean to take us off, but everything just kind of fit there for that story.
Yeah, great story. The name Lafayette, the man Lafayette, a lot of these things tie in together across the centuries. Absolutely. Going back to Jean Boulard's war service in World War II, how does he re-enter the war effort? Is he fighting for the Foreign Legion, I'm guessing, since the French government is under control, the Vichy French period? What does that all look like?
Pétain had given half of France, including Paris, to the Germans. He just literally surrendered them. And de Gaulle said, fight on, forever we will be the everlasting flame of freedom. And those words meant a lot. In fact, we used the recording of that in part two of our story that we did called All Blood Runs Red. And we've got it playing this week at our podcast at 1001 Heroes. He joined the French Foreign Legion. The Germans are trying to shell Orléans. And Boulard is assigned machine gun detail on the opposite side of the river from the Germans. And there's a huge fight going on to take Orléans, and his daughters are there at a convent where they're receiving their education. Again, remember, they're under the care of Kitty Terrier, who is his co-agent, and she's at this convent, and she's making sure that his daughters are safe. So he's involved in that shelling, and he was in a platoon. There were 17 guys with him, and they were crossing a street, and a German shell hit, and it killed everyone in his group except for lightweight Boulard. And he didn't get killed by the blast. He got thrown up against the wall, and he suffered a spinal injury, and it was pretty rough. But he, after a couple of days, he was able to stand, to crawl out of there, and to stand, and to get water. And he joined. He was useless for fighting now. He joined refugees trying to get out of France, and started on this line of refugees that was headed toward Biarritz, and there it is on the Spanish border. And he's trying to get to the Spanish border, because if he can get there, at the Spanish border, they're able to board ships. At least the Americans were able to board ships, which they were sending back to New York City. He knew his daughters were well cared for. He was able to get word to them. They were able to get word back to him. Yes, we're being well cared for. Get back to New York. Come back for us when you can. In his diary, he recorded a lot of the trials that happened during this long escape that they were making from France, along with refugees. He was a soldier in a French uniform. If the Germans caught these refugees, he would be immediately executed. There just wasn't any two ways about it. And he was barely limping along. The first doctor he managed to find was the same guy who had doctored him up in World War I. Unbelievable. Here it is, 25 years later, and the doctor says, "Well, good to see you back. Good to see you still standing, Gene." And he gave him enough painkillers that he could make it through the rest of this march. And in his diary, he had put that here we are on this bridge to freedom, this last international bridge over to Spain. And we stopped, and his doctor had given him a couple bottles of wine. And the people were resting there on the bridge, and they were passing. He had passed his bottles. He said, "I want to celebrate this with you." One of the families was called Levy. They were a Jewish family, and they were escaping like tens of thousands of other Jews, trying to get the heck out of France. And the lady at first refused to take the bottle. And he said, "I think you've got other worries than my microbes." He said, "We're on an international bridge anyway. I would suggest you take a drink. It might do you well for your luck." And she smiled, and they did. And for him, it was a moment of peace among people. And you had all these different nationalities trying to get away from the Germans on this bridge and crossing over to Spain. And he made it.
And then from Spain, does he go directly to the United States on a hospital ship, or are there other intermediate steps?
He managed to get on the hospital ship. He was the only black who was American. I think he was the only black on the ship. And they made it to the States, and he records the name of the ship and the pier number and everything else. And the guy who was organizing all these veterans, almost all of them wounded, was putting them up in hotels in New York City, all of them, and giving them a basic care kit and trying to get them squared away. And he was the one guy that they didn't get set up because he was black. So he's in New York City. He had whatever money he had on him. He had already been able to thanks to the friend Bob Scanlon that he had run into back at the embassy, I guess it was in Spain. They sent all his belongings, they sent his medals, all his paperwork, everything back to New York. And so that's how he ended up getting connected with all the paperwork to validate where he had been, the medals he had earned, the services he had done, everything. Thank God they had sent that back. And he was able to get that once he got relocated in New York, because they had a Veterans Bureau there in New York City. There were a lot of vets who'd fought in France and come back. And he joined that bureau, and that's where they had his stuff waiting.
Hmm. Bob Scanlon, was he another volunteer for the Foreign Legion?
Yeah, Bob Scanlon was an old vet who had joined the French Foreign Legion. And he knew him, ran into him. He thought Scanlon had been killed, but he met him on this trip out of Spain. So it was like meeting a dear old friend.
Well, I can't imagine what it was like for Boulard, who has lived in France for decades. He climbs the ladder of success. He's a professional athlete, then he's a professional musician. He's a club co-owner, then an outright owner, entrepreneur and everything. A war hero, someone who the government in France respects and trusts enough to make him an intelligence operative and not become a double agent. So obviously they respect him a lot. He has all that success, and then he comes to America and it's essentially gone. Did he write what it was like to go through that?
He said New York was a lonely place, but they did have a Legionnaires group there, although he was shunned from some of the meetings. He was able to attend some of the meetings as well. He had friends among that group, people he'd served with, and he also had enemies among that group because of his color. He was a very rare bird in terms that he was a black fighter pilot, and you have to wonder how many people took him at his word, you know, that he'd actually done that. He managed to get a job, and he managed to find a home in Harlem, a home that he lived in for the rest of his life. He got a job. Now, he can speak French extremely well. Because of his background, he spoke extremely well. He was able to connect with people. He had a sort of a savoir faire. And what was really big in the 50s in the U.S., especially in New York City, was French perfume. So darn if he didn't find a job as a perfume rep, where he made some pretty decent money because he had the language. He knew about Paris. He was selling Paris when he sold perfume. So he did extremely well with that, and he was able to find his grounding there. They also had a Catholic church in Harlem that offered a service in French because they had a large contingent of returning veterans who had come from France and French people who had come out of France to New York. So there was a large contingent of French in New York, and he also found a sort of a home there among them. So now he's kind of split. He still has a part of France there with him, which has kind of saved him. As he had terrible problems with stress until he got his daughters back, and with his spine, with his back, which never completely healed. He really did get slammed up against that wall of that building pretty hard, and that affected him the rest of his life. But during his time there, it was quite interesting because de Gaulle had come to the United States, and he had contacted the White House. And he said, listen, he says, I want to get in touch with my old friend, Jacques Boulard. He's a hero of France. And the White House said, sorry, we have no record of Jacques Boulard. We don't know who he is. So the White House did some quick looking, knowing that de Gaulle was due to come in just a week or so. And by the time de Gaulle came, they did manage to get Boulard's address and contact number. And de Gaulle contacted Boulard himself and met with him in public and invited him to be one of three men that he asked to come back and light the flame of the torch of freedom in Paris as a special tribute to the veterans, the American veterans who helped to save France. Quite a moment. And Boulard was one of those three men.
When was this?
This was in 1960, I believe. It was after the NBC interview. I believe it was in 1960.
Okay, so after that. His story is known again. From the period when he's in New York, he has friends with the French expatriate population and is trying to rebuild his life. From there to when he's working as an elevator operator in 1959, where our story begins, how does he get there? Is he continuing to work odd jobs and do whatever he can to make ends meet or some other way?
Well, obviously, he was selling French perfume, and he was doing pretty well at that. And the only other job we know that he had it for years, was an elevator operator. I think he became maybe too old to rep perfume at one point. So then he found the job at the NBC building. He also had some friends. One of his closest friends was an international singing star, a black guy, named Paul Robeson. And anybody wants to look up Paul Robeson on Wikipedia will find out that this guy was a huge, huge talent. Robeson was a known activist who had a lot of communist ties. In fact, he took his wife to live in Russia for a couple of years. So he was a leftist who fought hard from the left. He wasn't like Martin Luther King, who fought from the center and brought peace from the center. Robeson was a muckraker, and he created a lot of controversy. And he would do concerts in Westchester County in New York, 25 miles north of New York City. And his third concert, what they call the Peekskill Concert, he invited Boulard, who was now 55 years old, bespectacled guy, middle-aged guy, to join him at this concert. There were a lot of people who objected to the concert and didn't want to let the vehicles attending the concert in. So they formed lines that included state police, by the way. They formed lines of men who to block the cars and the limos and the vans that were coming in to hear Paul Robeson sing and to hear Paul Robeson talk. And they started pulling people out of cars and beating them. And Boulard had taken a bus. They stopped the bus, broke the windshields, got the people out of the bus, and they were beating him over the head with clubs. And that's on YouTube. There was a guy who took a video, and that's out there on YouTube today. So here you've got this tremendous hero with 40 medals who fought for France as an American and a Frenchman, and he's getting beaten over the head because he's going to a Robeson concert. It was definitely a shame and embarrassment for the state of New York and the city of Peekskill, one they'd like to forget forever. But there was a lot of hatred on the streets, and this was in the 50s.
Is that the reason that he's not well known today? Because at the end of his life, he's tied in with this activist movement?
I don't think so. I think the reason was because he fought for France and not because he fought for the U.S. The U.S. did try to make it right when the story came out. We had a 5-star general who was chief of staff of the Air Force, who in 1994 gave an honorary membership to the U.S. Air Force to Boulard once his story came out. And you go to the Air Force Museum, you'll find a special display there for Eugene Boulard. And you could say, well, it's a little late, but they did recognize his heroism, even though he did fight for France. And they recognized the fact that the United States should have brought him on as a pilot, and they didn't. But if nothing else, it tells us that America has come a long way in realizing what we owe to some of these guys and what we did to some of these guys. And there have been a number of books written about Boulard. One was called The Black Swallows of Death, which incorporated a part of Boulard's diary. And The Black Swallows of Death was the unit, that Moroccan unit, that was it was cited more for bravery than any other unit in the French Foreign Legion. And there were other books as well that came out. All Blood Runs Red was another book that came out. But one guy really summed it up when he said that what a colossal waste of decades for America, in the time that it's taken America to get over their racial hatred. What a colossal waste of time and money and resources and human lives. And it's stories of people like Boulard, hopefully that'll bring us together as a nation one day.
Well, I'm curious on what your take is on Boulard's life and if you could pinpoint anything of his legacy or his character that really stands out. Because as you were talking about his story and mentioning all these places that he ends up, it sounds a little bit like Forrest Gump, where he keeps showing up at all these important points in history. Except in that movie, Forrest Gump, Forrest just sort of stumbles in and he's a passive recipient, whereas Boulard isn't passive about anything. He jumps in, he will show up at a foreign shore with no money in a foreign country with no language. Somehow he manages to work his way in. Somehow he grabs onto a foothold wherever it is and manages to climb up and do something. So what is it about his life that really stands out to you and thinks should be remembered above all?
There was a three-word quote one of his author researchers said. He said, "One thing about Jacques Boulard, you can't help but ignore. He was game as hell."
There it is, game as hell. That should be the name of a biography there.
That would do good. There was a white lady in New York who befriended him. She was an author. Her husband was also an author. Her name was Louise Fox Connell. Mm-hmm. And her husband's name was Connell, and he had written a short story. I know that we did it, 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. And that short story was an excellent short story about a man trapped on an island and being used as game for a wealthy hunter.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember that story yourself. But she was his wife. She befriended Boulard, became very close to him, was his final biographer, got most of the story actually from him. And he told her she was at his deathbed when he died. And he said she was crying and she was torn up. And he looked at her and he got his breath together and he said, "Don't fret, honey. It's easy."
There you go. That's another example of being game. When it comes to the final transition, he's ready. Well, this was fantastic. I mean, there's so much to get into on his life. And this is what you do on your show. You find stories like these that you hope people remember. So, John, if people want to find your podcast and other things you're doing online, where is a good place for people to go?
Wow, that's a great question. I actually have a network of podcasts. It's called 1001 Stories Network. And if you search that at Google, you'll find a website that our host puts up for us where you can get every podcast we do from all 8 shows that we have on board there. But our flagship shows are 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries, where right now this week you'll find we brought it back from our archives, All Blood Runs Red, Parts 1, 2, and 3, the story of Eugene Jacques Boulard, as well as other World War I unsung heroes that we're including in this week. And usually we just come out every Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, but this time we're trying to put a show up every day of the week. Also, our show, 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales, is very, very popular. And a lot of great short stories from Jack London to Fitzgerald to Hemingway, all the great short story writers. We narrate those stories at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. And from those two shows, you'll find lots of other great entertainment, from our ghost stories to our greatest love stories to our 1001 Stories for the Road, where we do long format stories. We'll do it chapter by chapter. And some great adventure stories that from Treasure Island to loads of others, all there for your enjoyment at 1001 at Facebook. We're at facebook.com/1001heroes. At Twitter, we're 1001 Stories Podcast.
Okay, great. Well, we'll put that in the show notes and listeners can check out all that. John, thank you for joining us.
Scott, thank you so much for having us on. It's great working with you. Good luck with your books going forward. I know all of you already know it, but Scott is a fantastic author and has put some fantastic books on the market. And we look forward to every opportunity we can to do interviews with him. And you'll find interviews with Scott Rank at 1001 Heroes.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our fantastic spy masters include Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Jennifer French Lee, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial in Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Ryan Gillen, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, and Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers.
Though Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.